And now it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jill Smith. She is the professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Pennsylvania State University College of Medicine, Hershey Medical Center in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Please welcome Dr. Jill Smith.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'd like to thank Susie and Dr. Gluck for having me come to this meeting. Today I'm going to talk to you about the use of naltrexone in Crohn's disease. And I'll first review a little bit about what Crohn's disease is, which is considered an inflammatory disease similar to some of the other conditions that we'll hear about today. I don't know, he was going to dim the light. Ah, good. Wow, it's pretty dark up here. Inflammatory bowel disease includes conditions ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. There are also other inflammatory conditions of the bowel, including microscopic colitis, diversion colitis, diverticular colitis, and pouchitis. The two most common causes of inflammatory bowel disease are ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. These differ in that ulcerative colitis is a diffuse inflammation that involves the mucosa, which is the inner lining of the intestine. And it always starts down in the rectum and then can progress throughout the rest of the colon. It does not involve any other parts of the gastrointestinal tract and is always limited to the colon. Crohn's disease, on the other hand, can be patchy in distribution. There may be places that are normal and places that are inflamed throughout the bowel. Unlike ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease involves the entire thickness of the bowel. So it's transmural. Also, Crohn's disease typically involves the right side of the colon, which is the cecum, and the ileum of the small intestine. Crohn's disease can involve any part of the gastrointestinal tract from the mouth down to the anus. Today, my talk will focus primarily on Crohn's disease, which is a relapsing inflammatory condition of the intestinal tract. The peak age is in the first to fourth decades of life, and the prevalence is 100 to 200 per 100,000 in North America and Europe. Crohn's disease is an expensive disease and costs about $2 billion annually in medical costs in the United States alone, and it's associated with significant morbidity and decreased quality of life. Well, what are the symptoms related to Crohn's disease? The most common symptoms include abdominal pain and diarrhea. Patients with Crohn's disease can also experience weight loss and malnutrition if it involves the small intestine. They may also develop anemia either from blood loss or malabsorption of vitamins and iron. Patients with Crohn's disease can also develop fissures or fistulas, which are connections from the bowel to either the skin or to other organs. There are also some extraintestinal manifestations of Crohn's disease, which are conditions that occur outside of the intestine. One of these are aphthous ulcers, which can occur inside the oral cavity. Another is arthritis. And the arthritis that occurs in Crohn's disease is different than that of rheumatoid arthritis in that it usually is monoarticular, involving one joint. It's asymmetrical rather than symmetrical, and they do not have positive rheumatoid factors. Crohn's patients can also have skin manifestations, including erythema nodosum, which are nodules on the legs that are tender and red, or another condition called pyoderma gangrenosum, which is an ulceration. The other extraintestinal manifestation that Crohn's patients can have is iritis, or an inflammatory process of the eye. These conditions are important because we use these findings to help us make a Crohn's disease activity index score in our patients when we're following them for treatment. Well, what is the cause of Crohn's disease? We really don't know, and that's why these are all hypotheses. Some people believe that Crohn's disease may be caused by persistent infection from bacteria, including mycobacteria or viruses. Others believe that Crohn's disease may be because of a disruption of the normal bacteria flora or a dysbiosis that occurred from either infections or from antibiotic use. Another hypothesis includes that there may be a defective mucosal integrity, that the lining of the intestine has been broken down for one reason or another. And the other hypothesis is that there is a dysregulated immune response. When we look at inflammatory bowel disease, there are several etiologic agents in the pathogenesis. It appears that inflammatory bowel disease may occur in a genetically susceptible host, and when this host is exposed to different luminal or antigens, proteins in the gastrointestinal tract from either food or bacteria, and then environmental factors may trigger the onset of the inflammation. As far as the genetic influence with Crohn's disease, there is a familial occurrence, and it appears to be more prominent in Crohn's than with ulcerative colitis. The one mutation that has had some recent recognition is that of the NODE2 mutations that occur on chromosome 16 in patients who have Crohn's disease. Well, what environmental factors could possibly trigger a flare-up or an onset of Crohn's disease? Some may have to do with altered flora of the gastrointestinal tract, and whenever we take broad-spectrum antibiotics, this impairs the normal bacteria that are in the bowel. Diet may also play a role in causing flare-ups or activation of Crohn's disease. There may be some alterations in the barrier, such as infections that can occur, viral gastroenteritis that causes a breakdown in the mucosal lining, NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications such as ibuprofen can cause ulcers and breakdown in the lining anywhere throughout the gastrointestinal tract. Smoking is an interesting correlate in that the majority of patients who have Crohn's disease are smokers. And stress also seems to aggravate flare-ups of this disease. This complicated slide just reflects some of what we know about the molecular findings at the cellular action in inflammatory bowel disease. And just to make it simple for you, there are inflammatory cells that are involved in the bowel, as there are in other conditions such as MS and rheumatoid arthritis. These inflammatory cells release what we call pro-inflammatory cytokines when they're activated, and these are designated by the ILs or interleukin 2, 6, 12. They also release tumor necrosis factor alpha and gamma interferon. These inflammatory cytokines cause the inflammation from the white blood cells and macrophages. Well, how do we treat Crohn's disease in the clinical setting? The current therapy for Crohn's disease involves the use of aminosalicylates, which are similar to aspirin, and the salicylates work on the lining of the bowel to decrease the inflammation. Also, we use corticosteroids to try to suppress inflammation. Antibiotics have been tried, and immunomodulators are used to alter the immune response in patients with inflammatory bowel disease. These immunomodulators include azathioprine, which is Imuran, 6-mercaptopurine, which is a metabolite of Imuran, methotrexate, and the state-of-the-art treatment today is using the anti-TNF-alpha medications, which is the infliximab. Nutritional therapy has also been tried in Crohn's disease, and some patients, particularly pediatric population patients, use enteral supplementation or total parenteral nutrition. Unfortunately, there's some problems with the treatments that we have for Crohn's disease today. And some of the problems with these current treatments include that there may be frequent dosing. The aminosalicylates that are taken, such as Pentasa, require patients to take anywhere from 8 to 16 pills a day. And those are divided into 4 times a day dosing. Another major problem with the medications that are used for Crohn's disease is that they mostly suppress the immune system, making these patients at an increased risk for developing secondary infections and possibly cancer. Lastly, many of these medications are extremely expensive. One infusion of infliximab costs between $3,000 and $7,000, and patients who take this medication have to have infusions every 4 to 6 weeks. Well, what about the use of enkephalins or opioids in inflammatory bowel disease, and what is the literature supporting their role? First of all, it's thought that enkephalins experimentally may actually promote inflammation, and the immune cells that I mentioned before actually express opioid receptors, mu, kappa, and delta receptors. These opioids may actually induce the release of the pro-inflammatory cytokines from macrophages and T helper cells, and actually opioids have been shown to increase IL-12, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and interferon gamma levels. On the other hand, enkephalins have been shown to improve intestinal fluid absorption and to increase the immunity of the host. Enkephalin is found throughout the gastrointestinal tract, and there was a study published from Europe that showed when patients were given an enkephalinase inhibitor, which increased enkephalin levels, it improved cholera diarrhea and other types of diarrhea. Also, enkephalins have been shown to improve the immunity in patients with HIV disease, as we heard from Dr. Gluck. Well, naltrexone is an opioid receptor antagonist. We have shown that mice that were treated with a low-dose naltrexone had enkephalin levels that were elevated 15.6-fold greater than their controls. Naltrexone has also been shown to decrease tumor necrosis factor alpha and other inflammatory cytokines. Naltrexone stimulates DNA synthesis and promotes healing. So what is the mechanism of action of naltrexone, and how does it work in inflammatory bowel disease? Well, there is one school of thought that perhaps naltrexone works on the inflammatory cells and decreases the release of the mucosal cytokines. By doing this, it causes mucosal healing. The other school of thought is that low-dose naltrexone may partially block the opioid receptor. This results in an increase in endogenous enkephalins and an improvement in the immune system, and thus healing of the lining of the bowel. In our lab, we investigated the effects of naltrexone in inflammatory bowel disease by both studying an animal model and then studying the effects of low-dose naltrexone in a clinical human trial. In the animal study, we used a chemically induced colitis in C57 black mice. In the clinical human trial, we had approval by the Food and Drug Administration and by our institutional IRB to perform the study. I applied for and was assigned an investigational new drug number from the FDA in order to carry out these studies. And the study was funded by the Pennsylvania State University. Well, what was the purpose of our study? First, we wanted to evaluate the effects of naltrexone for treating active inflammatory bowel disease. We also wanted to investigate the mechanism by which naltrexone acts in inflammatory bowel disease, and then study the effects of different doses of naltrexone in an animal model. Also, we wanted to examine the safety and toxicity of naltrexone in human subjects who had Crohn's disease. First, I'll talk to you about the animal studies. And these were the methods for the animal studies. We used 9-week-old C57 black mice. They were randomly divided into 6 groups of 8 mice each. We used a standard model for inducing colitis in these mice, and that's by giving them 2% DSS, which is a chemical, dextran sulfate sodium, in their drinking water. The other half of the mice, which were the controls, had regular drinking water. On day 4 through 10, the animals were treated with either saline or naltrexone at doses of 0.1 or 10 milligrams per kilogram subcutaneously by an injection in a 0.1 cc volume. During the study, we had several parameters that we measured. We measured the water intake in the animals. We measured the animal weight. We measured their food intake, and we did stool hemocults. Each of the mice were housed separately so we could tell which animals were having rectal bleeding. And then upon sacrifice of the animals, the colons were dissected and weighed. They were examined under the microscope histologically for inflammation. And then we also extracted out of the colons RNA, ribonucleic acid, to analyze by a procedure called microarray analysis and also real-time PCR to see which proteins might be increased or decreased by the naltrexone therapy. The results of this study showed that all of the animals that were drinking the DSS supplemented water had evidence of colitis by day 5. One animal actually died in the DSS saline control group of the colitis. There were no animals that died in the naltrexone-treated groups. This slide shows the effects of the weight of the animals with naltrexone. On the top, with the black columns, are the control animals that were drinking untreated water. And you can see that compared to baseline, these animals all gained weight during the 10 days of this study. And there was no effects of naltrexone, either at the low dose or the higher dose, on the effects of weight. In contrast, all of the animals who received water that had the chemical DSS developed weight loss. The most significant weight loss was in the control animals that were only treated with saline, and there was a significant weight loss in these animals. The animals who were treated with the DSS water but then received naltrexone treatment began to have improvement and weight gain as the time of the study went on. And this was a significant improvement. This slide shows the effects of DSS and naltrexone on food intake and water intake. Of importance, in the control animals that received normal drinking water without DSS, you can see that when animals had naltrexone, it did not affect their food intake, and it did not affect water intake, except there was a slight decrease here in the lower dose naltrexone group. All of the animals who received DSS treatment and had colitis had some decrease in their food intake because these were sick animals, as you can see here. And the naltrexone did not have an effect on that food intake. Also, the same was true with the water intake. We calculated what we call a Crohn's disease activity index in our animals based upon their stool hemocult for blood, consistency of the stool, and their weight. What you can see in this slide is that the animals that were treated with just the regular drinking water had no activity or Crohn's colitis activity index, which is normal. The animals who received the DSS or received the colitis treatment all developed colitis, and this was significant. There was a great deal of inflammation, with 4 being the maximum amount of inflammation. When animals got naltrexone, the reversal occurred, and that the inflammation was significantly improved with the treatment of naltrexone. We also examined the colons under the microscope, And once again, the control animals did not have any significant inflammation. However, there was marked inflammation in the colons of all the animals that had DSS. And this inflammation was significantly improved with the treatment of naltrexone. I will point out here that even as we increased the dose of naltrexone, the reversal of inflammation was better than at the lower dose. This slide shows a histology of different sections of the colon from the mice, with the top panel being a control mouse who had no chemical DSS and was treated with saline. This is what a normal colon should look like. What you can see are these finger-like projections, or the crypts, that are filled with these mucus goblet cells, and there's very few, if any, inflammatory cells. When animals had colitis induced by DSS and were untreated, you can see that there's marked disruption of the crypts. There is marked inflammation. These little black dots are all inflammatory cells, and there are crypt abscesses that occurred. When we treated the animals with naltrexone, there was reversal of this damage and restoration of the normal architecture of the lining of the colon. Lastly, we looked at RNA to see what sort of pro-inflammatory cytokines might be involved with naltrexone. And actin was our control here, just showing that the treatment with naltrexone did not change a control marker, actin. The pro-inflammatory cytokines, IL-5, IL-12, and IL-6, are shown on this slide, along with their signal transduction downstream markers, STAT3 and STAT4. Basically, what this shows is that when the animals had the DSS, which is the second column in most of these, there was significant increase in the pro-inflammatory cytokines, showing that we had a good inflammatory bowel model for studying this condition. What we also found is that with the treatment of naltrexone, either dose, that the pro-inflammatory cytokine levels were all reversed by the treatment of naltrexone. So all of these came back down to baseline levels nearly with the treatment of naltrexone. So this is helping us understand a little bit more about the mechanisms and which inflammatory markers are involved when we use low-dose naltrexone. So to summarize the animal studies, naltrexone therapy in mice does not alter the weight of the animals, does not alter their food intake. It may decrease water consumption. It significantly improves the Crohn's activity index. Naltrexone also improves colonic histology. It reduces colonic inflammatory cytokines. And it appeared to be better at the higher dose than at the lower dose in this study. Now I'd like to move on to our human clinical trials that we conducted with low-dose naltrexone. The study design of the human trial was that of a phase 2 prospective open-label feasibility study, and the purpose was to test the safety and toxicity and efficacy of naltrexone in subjects with active Crohn's disease. The inclusion criteria for our study included patients who were 18 years or older. They had to have Crohn's disease activity by the CDIA Crohn's Disease Activity Index score of greater than or equal to 220. This is a standard score that's used by all gastroenterologists to indicate how inflamed the colon is. And it's based upon a 7-day diary that patients keep with their number of loose bowel movements, abdominal pain, overall well-being, temperature, and then also there are objective findings such as the blood count, the patient's weight, and physical examination. A score of 220 indicates that there is active disease. A drop of this score by 70 points indicates a response to treatment, and a score of 150 or less indicates remission. We also included people who had proven Crohn's disease either by biopsies, histology, by endoscopic procedures such as colonoscopy or by x-rays. Patients had to have normal liver enzymes to enroll in this study because high doses of naltrexone have been shown to be hepatotoxic. Patients also were not allowed to have an ostomy or a colostomy, and they had to be at least 4 weeks off of anti-TNF alpha therapy or infliximab, and they were not allowed to continue that medicine while on our study. The treatment in this study for the patients who met the inclusion criteria is that they were treated with naltrexone, 4.5 milligrams each evening for 12 weeks, and then followed for 4 weeks after the discontinuation of this medication. The subjects stayed on their baseline Crohn's medicine during the study at the exact same doses. Infliximab, as I mentioned, was not allowed during this study. The parameters that were measured in our clinical trial included the Crohn's disease activity scores, which a response is a decrease of 70 points, remission is 150 points or less. We also evaluated laboratory indices, a C-reactive protein and an erythrocyte sedimentation rate, which are known inflammatory markers in the blood, complete blood count, and chemistries. In addition, we evaluated two quality of life surveys. These are standard surveys used in Crohn's disease, the IBD questionnaire and the FS36 survey. To date with our results, we have 17 subjects that completed this pilot trial. Two subjects that had open fistulas had closure, and these patients had failed treatment with infliximab. Two subjects discontinued their routine medication against medical advice, and one of them flared. The other one did well and continued on their naltrexone alone. The patient demographics are shown on this slide. The mean age of our patients was 42 years. We had more females than males in the study. Their mean body weight was 72 kilograms. The most common location for their disease involved both the small bowel and the colon in about 60% of the patients, and about 30% had only colon involvement. We had 50% of the patients had a prior resection of their bowel because of the inflammatory bowel disease. And 76% of our patients had either a previous allergic reaction or had failed anti-TNF alpha therapy with infliximab. The medications that the patients were taking while on the low-dose naltrexone included, most patients were on aminosalicylates, about half were on immune modulators, 24% were on corticosteroids, and 6% on antibiotics. These medications were all kept stable at the same dose while on the treatment. This slide shows the results of the study at each of the four-week time intervals. First, at baseline, you can see that the Crohn's disease activity index score was above 350 in our patients, with 220 being required to enroll in the study and 220 indicating active disease. So these patients all had significant inflammation of the bowel. Within 4 weeks of starting low-dose naltrexone, there was a significant improvement in the Crohn's disease activity index. And this improvement continued throughout the study at week 8 and week 12 while the subjects were continuing to take the low-dose naltrexone. 4 weeks after discontinuing the naltrexone at week 16, patients still had improvement in their Crohn's disease activity index score, and this was not significantly different than while they were on the therapy. The low-dose naltrexone also was shown to increase the incidence of response and remission of Crohn's disease. As early as week 4, we had a response rate of close to 80% of the patients. And throughout the entire study, and even 4 weeks after discontinuing the low-dose naltrexone, there was a significant response to this treatment. Remission, which is no symptoms at all and a score of 150, we found that about 30% of the patients were already in remission at 4 weeks, and up to nearly 60% by 8 weeks. The slight decrease here may be that we included the one patient who flared when she discontinued her studies, because when we do scientific research, we include all patients as an intent to treat. We also did quality of life surveys, and this is the first one, which was the IBDQ survey. In this survey, we found that the quality of life significantly improved at each of the time intervals and even remained improved after discontinuing low-dose naltrexone. There was no significant difference between weeks 8, 12, and 16. On the SF-36 survey, there are a number of different quality of life factors that are evaluated, and I'll just show some of them to you here, just to indicate the significant improvement in quality of life that we found in different quality of life parameters in our patients. There was significant improvement in the role physical in patients who took low-dose naltrexone. The bodily pain was significantly improved. Energy was improved, and health perception was improved. And you can see that these remained improved even after stopping the therapy. Additionally, there was improvement in physical functioning, some improvement in social functioning. We did not detect any change while on naltrexone in the role emotional or emotional health part of this survey. However, the role emotional was increased after discontinuing the therapy. I hope you can see this in the back. It's a little dark from up here, but although colonoscopies were not included as part of our study because of the expense, one patient who underwent a colonoscopy before enrolling in our study and then had one done 4 weeks after enrolling in our study had significant improvement. What you see here is the rectum of this patient, and these white areas are ulcers in the intestine. The red areas are bleeding in the mucosa, and it's thickened and full of fluid and edema. 4 weeks after starting naltrexone, the rectum is back to normal endoscopically, and it's shiny. You can see my light shining there. Because you can see the blood vessels shining through the lining of the mucosa indicates that all the inflammation and edema has resolved. What about the results of the blood tests that we performed in our human study? We found that there was a significant decrease in the inflammatory markers, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, and a decrease in the C-reactive proteins. There was no change in the chemistries or the complete blood counts, and there was no change in the liver enzymes while on this study. We also measured enkephalin levels and performed them by radioimmunoassay. The enkephalin levels were drawn at the morning time of their visits, and we actually saw a decrease in the enkephalin levels in our patients. This could be related to the timing of when we drew the blood samples, or something that we don't understand about how the mechanism of naltrexone really works. But there was not a significant change, although the trend was a decrease in the enkephalin levels. What were the side effects in our patients taking low-dose naltrexone? Well, the most common side effect was sleep disturbances. 7 of our patients noted insomnia, and 1 had unusual dreams. 5 of our subjects changed their dosing from evening to morning because of this side effect, and they continued to have improvement in their inflammation regardless of the timing of the treatment. Other side effects that were reported were all minor side effects and all reported just one time in one patient. That included nausea, hair thinning, irritability, blurred vision, mood swings, and mild disorientation. To summarize our human studies, we found that low-dose naltrexone therapy improved the Crohn's disease activity index scores. It improved the quality of life in patients who had active Crohn's disease. It increased the chance of obtaining a remission from inflammatory bowel disease. Also, it decreased the blood inflammatory markers, and it had minimal side effects. So what might be the advantages of naltrexone in this condition? First, it can be administered orally. Infliximab has to be given by an intravenous infusion, which requires people to miss time from work. So this can be given just once a day dosing too, compared to some of the other medications used for Crohn's disease, which require 8 to 16 pills a day. It appears that naltrexone down-regulates but does not completely eliminate the pro-inflammatory cytokines, as we found in our real-time PCR data. We also found that it has very few side effects. There can be a lot of side effects from the other medications used for Crohn's disease. It only has to be given once a day, and it's extremely cost-effective. It cost our study about $45 to $50 per patient per month for naltrexone, compared to the $3,000 to $7,000 a month for infliximab. Well, what is one of our proposed mechanisms for how naltrexone might be working in the inflammatory state? This diagram shows a T helper cell, which is lining the bowel, and a macrophage. These are the cells that are responsible for secreting the pro-inflammatory cytokines IL-6, IL-12, and TNF-alpha and interferon gamma. These cells also have been reported to have opioid receptors on their membranes. Opioids can interact with these opioid receptors, and in doing so, scientific studies have shown that by treating these cells with opioids or enkephalins, that you can increase the release of these inflammatory cytokines. Naltrexone blocks the action of these opioids at their receptors, and thus decreasing the release of the pro-inflammatory cytokines. So that's one possible mechanism by which naltrexone may be working. There may be other roles that the opioids or naltrexone may have in healing. First of all, opioids have been shown to inhibit cell division. And I have a particular interest in opioids because I do cancer research. I'm funded by the FDA in an orphan drug study where we're actually treating patients with pancreatic cancer with enkephalin infusions. So enkephalin itself will inhibit the growth of cancer. Naltrexone has been shown to also promote cell migration and to repair corneal abrasions in patients who have diabetes. Well, there are several types of opioid receptors, and I've listed them for you here, and they have different actions. We do not know which one of these receptors or if all of these receptors are involved in the low-dose naltrexone. The mu, delta, and kappa receptors are found on the plasma membrane and are involved with analgesia and pain control. The kappa receptors are found on the cells that help regulate fluid and electrolyte balance, and the delta receptors we know are found on the inflammatory cells. Our lab has cloned and sequenced the OGF receptor, which is actually a nuclear receptor that binds enkephalin, and it's the only receptor of all these that is involved in growth, and that's the mechanism by which the enkephalins inhibit growth of cancer. Well, some questions come up, I'm sure, with my presentation. We all have certain mindsets, and sometimes we have to change our way of thinking. I set out with the idea that the enkephalin levels were going to be markedly elevated in our patients after we gave them low-dose naltrexone, only to find that that wasn't the case. Also to find that the animals who received the higher dose of naltrexone did better than the animals that got the lower dose of naltrexone. So we really don't know what is the ideal dose. We know that the low-dose naltrexone is safe. We don't know if we could go up a little bit better and still have the safety that's involved. Also, in our patients who were unable to tolerate the naltrexone in the evening still had the benefits of the naltrexone when they took it in the morning. So this may mean that in certain inflammatory conditions, it may be working by a different mechanism, by affecting the pro-inflammatory cytokines. We also don't know whether the effects of the naltrexone are because it's increasing the enkephalin levels and that it's enkephalin-mediated, or is it because we're inhibiting the enkephalins? So there's a lot of research that needs to be done in this area for us to understand it better. So which way do we go from here? As far as our future studies, we plan to do a clinical phase 2 placebo-controlled trial in patients with Crohn's disease, and we have a grant that's been submitted here to the NIH that's going to be reviewed this month. So hopefully we'll get a favorable review and can continue our studies in patients. It would be interesting to evaluate different doses of naltrexone to find out what is the best dose that is used. Also, we would like to evaluate longer therapy to see if longer therapy is safe in patients. And we do want to understand the mechanism of action of naltrexone. We've also submitted another grant to the NIH using animal models to study the effects of naltrexone in inflammatory conditions. So in conclusion, naltrexone therapy appears to be effective for active Crohn's disease. Naltrexone therapy is well tolerated, and future studies are needed to understand the role of naltrexone in Crohn's disease as well as in other inflammatory disorders. And I want to give thanks to everybody here. I have to thank my mentor, Jesus, through whom all things are possible, who gives me the knowledge and wisdom to stand before you today, a grant from Penn State University and our General Clinical Research Center, my collaborators at Penn State, Dr. Zagon, Dr. Harms, Dr. Matters, Dr. Majors, and Dr. Fitzpatrick. Also my nurse coordinator, Sandra Bingaman, who's my right-hand woman, medical student, Heather Stock, and two college students, Anuj Parikh and Nick Nilo, who helped me with the animal studies. Thank you for your attention. Questions? Okay. Yes.
May I ask you, did you look at the enkephalin measurements in the subgroups, that is to say the 5 patients who took it, the dose in the morning as against the other 12? Did you see any difference between the two if you looked at that?
We didn't separate out the ones who took it in the morning versus the evening, but we could do that.
Great.
Since the study was small, we grouped them all together. And overall, there was a decrease from baseline. Surprised me. But that's what science is about. Yes, sir?
Recently, there was cited a bacterial cause for Crohn's disease. It got some publicity around the world. And just like in the case of gastric ulcers and duodenal ulcers and H. pylori, do you think that this particular cause may have some validity in Crohn's disease?
It would be nice. We've been looking for an agent for a long time. There's a condition in cows called Joni's disease, which is caused by a mycobacterium that resembles Crohn's in human subjects, but they have not been able to identify one particular organism. Some patients seem to respond to antibiotics, but it appears to be a multifactorial condition, as I mentioned, possibly in a genetically susceptible host who is exposed to this particular bacteria that might have some defect in their mucosal lining that makes them get the infection. But we do not have a handle yet on what organism or which antigen it could be. Yes?
Thank you, Professor Smith, for your presentation and for giving some scientific muscle to what we've experienced clinically from people giving this medicine. My name is Dr. Phil Boyle. I'm a GP, a family physician from Ireland. But my big interest is in with infertility. And one of the things we found with enkephalin levels, opioids, is that there's a marked cyclical variation in opioids throughout the cycle. And because there's a large number of females in your group, I'm wondering if you took into account the day of the cycle that the blood test was taken on, and maybe the natural cyclical variability in enkephalins is why you didn't notice an increase in the opioids with naltrexone.
Hmm. I mean, that's an interesting thought. In order to be included in our study, obviously, whenever you do research studies, patients have to be on some sort of contraceptive, according to the FDA guidelines. So that may also play a role in how that would affect the levels. As you know, when you use low-dose naltrexone, if it binds to the receptor, these are peptides, and they all are short-lived in the plasma. So it's possible that since we didn't do pharmacokinetic studies, meaning that we drew blood samples 30 minutes, 1 hour, 3 hours, and so forth, after people took their naltrexone, we may have missed a peak in the enkephalins. I know the theory about the cyclic and the diurnal secretion of enkephalins and the rationale for giving it in the evening. That's why we started off giving it in the evening. I'm just suggesting that there may be other possible mechanisms involved with its role, and in those who can't tolerate in the evening, it may still work giving it in the morning, but no one's ever looked at that. So, yes.
How many of your patients were taking opioid antidiarrheal medications like loperamide or diphenoxylate?
They had to record that. Very few of our patients, but if they had to take Imodium, they took it, and that was recorded in their Crohn's disease activity index scores.
So you don't, are you saying you don't know how many of them were taking the drugs?
Out of the 17, probably about 2 or 3, not very many. It wasn't that common.
Okay.
They're allowed to take them if they need to take them, but it is all recorded. So we do have that data that I can check.
I mean, my question is that, considering your proposed mechanism for the action of naltrexone, I mean, loperamide in particular is a very potent mu receptor agonist,
mm-hmm.
right? So I'm just, I mean, based on your mechanism, then wouldn't you expect use of that type of medication to actually cause the disease to become worse?
Mm-hmm. I don't think any of our patients were taking Lamotil, but they were allowed to take...
I meant loperamide.
Imodium. It's possible that could be involved. I don't think that... It was enough to affect our results.
Do you know of the patients who were using the antidiarrheals? Did the naltrexone reverse the effect of that medication?
All of our patients had a response to the naltrexone.
No, I meant the patients concurrently taking the antidiarrheal medication. Was the effect of the antidiarrheal medication affected by the naltrexone?
I don't know that. I don't know. Yeah, sure.
Let me comment on that. The low-dose naltrexone in 12 of the patients were taken at night, right? And the time of action of a low dose of naltrexone in a human, when you take it at bedtime, may be no more than 3 or 4 hours, actually. So if you were to use an opioid during the day, you wouldn't really expect any blockade. I don't know about the other five. Mm-hmm.
If patients had to take those medications, or if patients had to take a pain medication such as codeine, we required them to wait a minimum of 3 hours from their dosing, if that helps you at all, so that it wouldn't interfere with the action.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Yes?
Are there any future studies for the effect of low-dose naltrexone on other inflammatory bowel diseases, such as ulcerative colitis?
We hope so. Right now, we have a pending grant at the NIH for Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. I think that once we move ahead with that and we get some more approval through the FDA showing its safety and efficacy, that I'm hoping that there'll be more studies that come out. it would be nice to know if we could even give infusions, you know, of enkephalins, and will that reverse an acute flare-up? We don't know. So there's a whole area of investigation that's open to researchers here.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hold it on. Okay. I'm Dr. McAllis. I'm going to be talking next about autism. And as you know, we're very interested in the immune parameters for our children. And I wonder, in terms of Dr. Bahari's finding that the higher the dose, the more the immune system was impaired with the AIDS patients that he was studying, I was interested that your patients, some of them, did better on the higher doses. And I wonder if the next time you do this, if you raise the doses, if you might consider measuring the natural killer cell levels, the immunoglobulin levels, and some of the new studies on the regulator cells, the CD4, CD25 T cells, to see if in the higher doses there is any change in those immune parameters.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, so that we only use the higher dose in the animals.
Oh.
In our human studies, we used the low dose, which was 4.5 milligrams, and that was the only dose that was used. So, you know, it was only in the animal model, and whether you can really relate what's the right dose in an animal that relates to a human subject. So we do plan, and in the grant that we've submitted to the NIH, to look at the different doses, first in animals, so that we can easily study the different inflammatory cells and to see which ones are regulated. So there is a possibility, as you mentioned, that possibly these people have a defective immune system and we need to improve their immune system. There are some studies going on in Crohn's disease at the present time where they're actually giving Crohn's patients granulocyte colony stimulating factor to improve their immunity to help fight the inflammation. So it's a whole other area of research.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yes?
You said that you were doing some studies in cancer therapy. Are you willing at some point in time to extrapolate that this might be a prevention for colon cancer?
We've done and actually published a lot of work using enkephalin in colon cancer. And actually, enkephalin works very well for colon cancer. I've been studying pancreatic cancer for many years because there is no other effective treatment for pancreatic cancer. And we've completed and published a phase one clinical trial in pancreatic cancer, and we're now in the middle of our phase two clinical trial. In that study, though, we're giving infusions of metenkephalin, 250 micrograms per kilogram. Certainly, there's differences between the types of cancers, and patients with colon cancers probably would respond better, because in our animal studies, when we gave our animals enkephalins, we only had to treat them once a day to get the colon cancer to resolve, whereas in our pancreatic cancer animals, we had to treat them 3 times a day. So there are differences in the cancers. Because of that, colon cancer might be susceptible to treatment with low-dose naltrexone. Something like pancreatic cancer, it depends. They may need higher doses of enkephalins than you can get from just the low-dose naltrexone, and that's why we're given it as an infusion. There's a question in the back, I think.
For patients who are not responding to different types of treatments, even like corticosteroids that are, you know, medications that are highly toxic, would you have them consider using LDN, even though, you know, the safety has not been fully established? That's number one. Number two, you mentioned that as far as, you know, the need for future studies for ulcerative colitis. But do you think that the results that you've seen with Crohn's, with carryover, do you think it's going to be as effective from your assessments with ulcerative colitis? And would you actually, as I said, advise somebody who's exhausting all options and not seeing any response to even begin to consider this route, considering that the other medications are highly toxic, so that's not even a, you know, it's something to look at, so.
Mm-hmm. I would hope that the treatment with low-dose naltrexone, as it worked well in Crohn's disease, would also work in ulcerative colitis, because they're similar conditions, and we know that our medical therapy for one condition like Crohn's also works with ulcerative colitis. So I would presume that it would work. As far as, you know, would you prescribe it to someone who has failed all other therapy? I would. There's some issues that physicians deal with in something that is off-label. And that's a legal issue that, you know, maybe this group of people can help push the FDA to maybe approve low-dose naltrexone for other uses. Because some physicians will not write a prescription for a medicine that is not FDA approved. Because I hold a license for low-dose naltrexone from the FDA, I'm allowed to prescribe it. But I still have to send in quarterly reports to the FDA about our studies and how patients are doing, any side effects. You know, certainly I have no hesitation in using low-dose naltrexone, and I feel that it's much safer than a lot of the alternatives that are out there. I'm involved in lots of pharmaceutical studies, and I've been involved with infliximab and the Antigrin and other anti-TNF-alpha drugs that are out there, and I'm concerned about their use in young, healthy people and the risk of infections and cancers. So I would prefer to use something that appears to be much safer, such as low-dose naltrexone, than some of the more toxic drugs.
So just a final question. What would you, if somebody wants to consider that and try it, where would you advise them to go, considering that doctors, most of them would not prescribe it, and where should they go?
Comment on that, please.
Sure.
We have a website, www.ldninfo.org. If you will write to the website, we will give you suggestions. May I say to the speaker, which I failed to say before, your wonderful pioneering work is certainly something to be applauded, and we very much appreciate what a breakthrough you're going to make when this gets presented to the big conference. I wanted to point out to you that one of your slides, which speaks about the advantages of naltrexone, doesn't contain that point that you've just made, which I would love to see up on that slide, which is that naltrexone doesn't carry that risk of infections and cancer in the future, the mm-hmm. potential risk that the mm-hmm. immunosuppressants do. I wish you could add that.
And that's with low dose. We have to be careful, because as you escalate the dose of naltrexone, that may carry a risk of causing cancer.
We don't know.
Because we use the enkephalins to inhibit cancer. So obviously, if you block the receptor, you may increase the risk. Mm-hmm. So that's why the dosing is very important.
Absolutely. By the way, is there an animal model for an autoimmune inflammatory disease of the bowel?
There's a lot of animal models, and one of the ones that we're using is called an IL-10 knockout model. There's actually also a metenkephalin knockout model.
Really?
There are a lot of animal models that are available. We use the DSS, which is just a chemically induced colitis, but there are a lot of genetic knockout models available to study this disease. Yes, sir.
Doctor, I really enjoyed your presentation. It's so thorough and very stimulating. I just wanted to mention for the gentleman in the back of the auditorium as to how to find a place where this could be prescribed. I would suggest two things from our tiny bit of local experience. Number one, check with your own physician, because some are, particularly psychiatrists, are very familiar with naltrexone and may be willing to write an off-label prescription, even though they're not interested in inflammatory bowel or cancer. But also, in searching out a compounding pharmacy, I found one in our locality. I didn't even know it was there, but it has great credentials, apparently. And I went to visit them, and I said, could you possibly make up low-dose naltrexone as one of your products? Oh, he says, I already do it. I said, you mean somebody in this town is already using it? Oh, yes, Dr. So-and-so, a block away, who we happen to know. In general, if you find a sort of, he's an internist, but holistically oriented. So you may be able to find amongst the, let's call it the more flexible, integrative medicine types of physicians, a willingness to write a prescription.
Mm-hmm. I use a compounding pharmacy in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Because our study was monitored by the FDA, they had very strict regulations, and they had to even send off their low-dose naltrexone to be evaluated by two different pharmacies, one in Oklahoma and one in New Orleans. So they had very strict guidelines. I believe that, you know, the purpose of doing some of this scientific research is to help prove to the medical community, who can be hard-minded and not open to the treatment unless you can prove it to them. And that's why it's important for us to do placebo-controlled trials and to do the correct statistics and to really evaluate in a scientific manner to prove to the medical community that it is safe and it is efficacious. So there's another question. Yes.
My name is Mary Bradley. I'd also like to thank you for a wonderful presentation. I wrote the book Up the Creek with a Paddle, detailing my husband's success with LDN, treating his multiple sclerosis. What I found interesting today was you said that the benefits of the LDN lasted another 4 weeks when the patients came off the medication. And I'm wondering if you have an opinion as to, would they go back on it, or do you think the mechanism was fixed, or what's the duration, in your opinion, people should be on the medication, perhaps?
In our study, certainly these are patients that I follow, so I can only tell you anecdotally, since it wasn't included in the study, some of the patients who were in that study are still in remission without taking anything, and it's been over a year. Some of the other patients who had their symptoms return, I placed them back on low-dose naltrexone. Their insurance companies covered the medication when it was prescribed at a compounding pharmacy. So I think it's each patient is going to be different, and so it's really just monitoring the patient and seeing. But we were pleased that the effect lasted, because certainly when people come off corticosteroids, for example, their symptoms frequently return within a couple of weeks. So we were pleased that it was more durable than some of our standard treatments. But, yes.
So just to that last point, can you tell us the couple of patients who you did have to put back on low-dose naltrexone, how did they do?
They've done fine. I mean, I'm following them, and they're still in remission without any therapy.
But I was speaking specifically about the ones where you said there were a few that you said after a while, after being off a while, you put them back on the low dose. And I was just wondering if you had any experience.
It worked again when they went back on the low-dose naltrexone. Most of these patients we still maintain on their aminosalicylates, which is a maintenance drug, but I do my best to get them off immunomodulators. We did find, it seems, that patients who were not on immunosuppressive drugs, such as Imuran or corticosteroids, went into remission faster. So if you can get patients off their drugs that suppress the immune system, it seems that the low-dose naltrexone works more rapidly. I don't know if that's statistically significant, but it may be important in the long-term follow-up of patients, and maybe those who don't need immunomodulators will stay in remission longer. So. Well, thank you so much for your attention.